From PowerlineBlog.com and produced by Ricochet.com, this is The Powerline Show with your host, Steve Hayward.
Well, welcome back to the second half of my conversation with Charles Murray and Steve Saylor. Now, after we recorded last week, the news came out that the Supreme Court would take up the challenges to affirmative action admissions policies at Harvard and the University of North Carolina, where it has been solidly demonstrated that the universities don't just use race as a minor tie-breaking plus factor, as the infamous Bakke case put it, but indeed, Harvard and North Carolina and many other universities put both feet on the scale in favor of blacks and to a lesser degree Hispanics, and heavily against Asian applicants. Well, this makes for the perfect launching point for the second half of this conversation, where we jump in exactly where we left off in part one. When we left off, Charles and Steve Saylor had just reviewed the falling crime rates in Hispanic communities, and we resume here with Charles bluntly and directly arguing that affirmative action is the 50-ton elephant in the room, and not just in college admissions. And from there, we turn to the subject of education and take up the changing views of meritocracy and suggest alternatives for preserving excellence in education in a new era where all the familiar screens of the SAT and other achievement tests are quickly being abandoned. Now, Charles and Steve have perspectives on these subjects that might surprise listeners. So let's get back to them right now.
Well, you've just touched on, it seems to me, sort of the unwritten story for the next decade. And, okay, this falls under the category of pure speculation. I think it is entirely possible that as the fever breaks on wokeism, blacks are going to find that they are increasingly isolated as a minority. And once that happens, well, this is a topic that I really would like to hear what you have to say on it, both Steves. The amount of cognitive, I'm just shifting gears here, Steve Hayward, and I'll leave you to deal with the tape and make whatever you will. I think we are dealing with a huge problem of cognitive dissonance in elite America, white elite America, that is going to feed into the disaffection of Latinos from blacks and of Asians from progressives. And by cognitive dissonance, I mean in the academy, the white professoriate in who are in the serious disciplines know that the blacks in those disciplines have often gotten PhDs who should never have been awarded their PhDs. They know that. They are embarrassed in many cases by the work that is published by their black colleagues in law firms, in hospitals, in K-12 schools. Whites know that because of aggressive affirmative action, and that is the culprit, they know that the job performance as a whole in these groups is radically different. I'm hesitating to get into this because, you know, I have as much of an impulse as anyone else to say the fact that the average K-12 black teacher is a standard deviation below the average white K-12 teacher makes me say, but there are some brilliant black teachers out there. And yes, there are. And there are brilliant black physicians and the rest of it. I'm saying that the differences in job performance are great enough because of aggressive affirmative action that you have all these whites out there who are saying all the right things in terms of their progressive credentials and what they're going to do to increase people of color in their organizations. And the other part of them is saying, oh, gee, I'm really getting tired of dealing with this these employees we have, which just aren't up to snuff, and they happen to be black, and that's something I don't want to think about. That's going on in a large portion of white corporate America and white academia. Nobody wants to talk about it. At what point does that boil over? At what point does the cognitive dissonance get resolved? And how will it get resolved? It's almost as if we have a perfect storm forming.
Yeah. You know,
of different forces that are going to play out in ways that we can barely imagine right now.
Well, the tragedy of this is it also drags under those truly outstanding Black performers. And you know, I can think of a couple of really outstanding Black students I've had, including this one Black girl who I encouraged to apply to Ivy League law schools. She was hesitant, 99th percentile on the LSAT, top grades. Turns out she was a classics major, learning Greek and Latin. A bit of an outlier, you might say, right? Got the top grade in one of my classes. And she said, well, I'll tell a little more of the story. I said, where do you want to go to law school? And she mentions a bunch of good but second-tier places. And I said, look, you know, with your scores and your ability, you should be applying to Harvard, Yale, Chicago, Michigan, Berkeley, et cetera. And she said, and I barely knew her at this point, she said, yeah, but I'm afraid I'd only get in as an affirmative action person. I'm a little worried about the work. And I said, I've seen your work. You can compete head-to-head with the best of the people at those schools. And she did, by the way, ultimately go to one of the top schools. It's done very well. But a person also, like hers can be under that shadow, right?
Yeah, and imagine her situation. She gets in there. She can go head-to-head with them. She also knows that the other Blacks who are accepted to that law school as a whole are substantially below the ones who got into, was it Harvard Law that she went to?
She didn't go there. She went to Cornell.
Cornell, okay.
It's a top 10 law school.
She knows that's the case?
Yeah.
They also know that's the case as they watch her. And the whites who are in the law school admits, they understand all of this. It's a really ugly situation. And it's also very sad for her because some part of her wants to stand up and say, I'm here because I deserve to be here.
Right.
And she can't do that either.
Yeah, right, right. All right, for the second half of our conversation, I'll edit all this later, so let me start that again. All right, for the second half of this, I want to drill down into some more precise questions about education, about merit, meritocracy, testing, all the things that are in a great turmoil right now. There are a couple of loose ends from our first part that I do want to touch on as a general matter. One of them is what's happened very suddenly is that equity, which really means redistribution and old-fashioned, rigid, socialist, egalitarian leveling, but equity has replaced equality, which most Americans, I think, still understand and cherish as equality of opportunity, even though that's been a problem for decades. So equity has replaced equality, and that is part of the story, it seems to me, of why meritocracy is under attack. And Charles, I know you mentioned Michael Sandel, and there are other authors on the left who are critical of meritocracy, but the rush to abandon entrance exams like the SAT and IQ test and other things looks like that is being done in part so that the racial balancing and the quota mentality of the left can be maintained. I also have a theory that universities are rushing very fast to get rid of the SAT because they're trying to get ahead of what they expect will likely be an adverse ruling from the Supreme Court in the Harvard admissions case.
Uh-huh.
That's my, that's my suspicion about things. By the way, I will mention in passing, the Berkeley Faculty Senate, when the proposal was brought up 2-3 years ago to abolish the SAT for admissions, voted overwhelmingly against the idea. I mean, again, that's mostly liberal faculty, but they understand how they get good students and they want good students to continue to come there. And they don't like the idea that it's going to become something less than that, which I think is kind of interesting. I didn't ask a very good question, but this how do you size up this rush to attack and overturn meritocracy? Who wants to go first? Steve, you want to try it first?
Yeah, I'll toss in my theory, which is first, I call it kind of the not so great reset, that the country was kind of running for a long time on the country was running on, oh, well, here's how we do things. If you want to apply to college, you got to take the SAT. And then came COVID, and they had to cancel SAT in the spring of 2020. So then they had to, so the establishment had to improvise a bunch of other things. And when they did that, then all of a sudden, all of these issues of disparate impact that had been kind of swept under the rug is like, well, that's just what we do. We're an elite college, so we get elite students using the SAT and the ACT. We're then brought up to like, okay, we can't do that this year, so what are we going to do next year? And then the new principles of the Great Awakening, the Ibram X. Kendi theory, that any example of unequal performance is proof of systemic racism, then came into play. Oh, we got to improvise. We got to do something else. Wait a minute. How come Asians do better than whites, who do better than blacks? And, well, that's got to be systemic racism. It's got to be evil, America's original sin. That's the only possible explanation. So what do? We get rid of it. The other theory I'd toss out is that the reason there hasn't been that much resistance is because upper middle class whites are kind of shell-shocked by Asian test scores. A Twitter account named Unsilenced Science keeps track of SAT and ACT scores year after year. And basically, the racial gaps stay about the same, except Asians in the 21st century have been pulling away from everybody else. The Asian score just keeps going up, up, up. And why is that? Is it selection? Is it more gigantic amounts of test prep? Another really good question that people need to look into, but it's kind of undermined the upper middle class white support for testing.
Yeah, no, I see. I'll interrupt for a minute. I have thought for a while that the public choice people had this analogy of bootleggers and Baptists. You know, it was the bootleggers supported the Baptist politicians to keep liquor illegal so they could sell their bootleg whiskey. And in this case, I think that I think you're onto something, which is that a lot of white middle class parents are sympathizing with, I'll call it the quota regime. That's not quite right, because they see suppressing Asian admissions as a way of keeping more spots open for themselves.
Yeah.
Right.
And you know, the
Charles impact, is laughing at me, but
the impact of Asian cultural norms of test prepping on the quality of your child's life, like, well, off to the test prep center for 10 hours a week. You know, is that really a way to go through your high school years for 3 or 4 years doing that? I don't know. Charles and I have been kicking around reforms.
We'll get to that. Charles looks like he's chomping at the bit to get in here.
Well, yeah, I think we need to deconstruct the we take this question and talk about equity versus equality as one topic, but let's just stick with the SAT and a particular issue right now that's going on at the universities, because it's absolutely fascinating. And I agree with much of what you were saying, Steve, but let's also have a little perspective on how many people are really concerned about the SAT scores of their kids. Because the fact is, very small percentage of American universities are highly selective. Some of the good state universities have gotten, quite selective in terms of the applications they've gotten, the slots they've gotten for them. But still, you take, of all the people who go to colleges, it's a relatively small set focused among the upper middle class of people who are trying to get into this rare good called an elite school. So it's a small segment of the population. Secondly, you have, And by the way, I don't have a coherent theory of why it's gone on. But secondly, you have with the universities now a huge disconnect between the understood importance of intellectual ability in the classroom and their need to protect their progressive credentials. People in the physics department know that in order to major in physics, you have to be really smart in the IQ sense of that term, and specifically in visual spatial skills. There is no doubt in their minds that that's the case. There is no way that there can be physics department faculty anywhere who are happy about getting rid of the SAT or the GRE for choosing their graduate students, especially. They can't be happy about it in terms of what's best for their discipline, but either they can somehow compartmentalize in their mind and believe in the progressive bullshit about all of this, or they are afraid to say out loud what they believe. And so you have the people in the admissions offices and in the administrative support who are true believers in all of this, many of whom are people of color. So is there anybody in these universities, in the elite universities, who are saying to themselves, we're shooting ourselves in the foot? Our graduates get interviewed by Goldman Sachs, not because Goldman Sachs thinks we've made these kids suitable employees, but because they got in. We are fishing in the Harvard pool of graduates because the Harvard pool of graduates is dense with great big fat carp by the admissions process. And once we no longer are able to say of our student body that they're really, really smart, sooner or later, the prestige of that institution is going to suffer. When I make this point, people say, you don't understand. The brand quality of Harvard and Yale and Princeton is so strong, it'll just never be, it'll never go away. I'm not so sure, because if I'm in Goldman Sachs now, I'm saying, gee, I wonder where all those Asian kids who aren't getting into Harvard are going to school. And they're going to get much more interested in the honors programs at good state universities. And they are going to get less interested in the elite universities. And I think that at some point, the people who are running these universities and wanting to get big contributions from alumni are going to be saying to themselves, we are not going to be producing alumni who are going to be in a position to give us multi-million-dollar grants in the future.
Yes, a form of social science research that I'd love to get my hands on, but seems to be top secret, is Harvard, Yale, Stanford's studies of who writes the big checks 40 years after you let them in. My impression is it's pretty much the straight white male jock legacy athlete types that are most despised, but they make the most money and they're the most loyal. So this could backfire. It could also be that Harvard has a plan that, like, okay, we're gonna spend a whole bunch of money studying these applications and figuring out ways to figure out which ones are smart, and we'll get to pretty much the same result. As we had with test scores, but, you know, from Brown on down, they're not going to be able to do that. And it's just going to be random, and you're going to get a lot of kids in there who don't know what they're doing. And so it could be that it just, you know, HYPS comes out even more superstars and the next tier nosedives. So,
yeah, you know, I have heard some anecdotes, and of course, we need data on this, but I've heard anecdotes of some companies saying, we're not looking to recruit from Harvard and Yale anymore. They tend to be, what you hear in the anecdotes is, it tends to be, you know, Cummins engine, you know, manufacturing in the heartland. And so I wonder, Charles, if I think you might be right, but we might also see a bifurcation in which it's another aspect of, or an extension of coming apart, which is sort of old line, you know, brick and mortar, actually make things kinds of businesses and real estate to some extent. We'll say, no, I'm not going to do the Ivy League people. They're too entitled. You know, the cliches you hear, but that Goldman Sachs and the white shoe law firms will still, in other words, it'll be a great, that divide will deepen and continue and stratify in ways that we're already seeing happen.
I think you've already got a situation where corporations are doing a very good job of maximizing the people they want to get. So I have an anecdote where I can't name the name, because the name is well known, but a big corporation where the CEO said to me, we don't even interview at Harvard and Princeton, Yale anymore. We don't want them. We're sick of them. We're sick of their sense of entitlement. We're sick of their unwillingness to work the kinds of hours we want to work and so forth. They're getting the kids they want. Meanwhile, out at the high tech, I have heard stories about the Google interview process, which make me really happy. I'm not trying to get a job at Google because I couldn't get one. I mean, where I have heard some of the interview questions they ask, which are incredibly ingenious, and which they are not administering IQ tests. They're not going to get in trouble with the feds for violating guidelines on testing, but they are, in the course of their interviewing, identifying exactly the people they want, the people who are three standard deviations out on the skill sets that they want. And guess what? Private corporations, eager to make a profit, are not willing to shoot themselves in the foot as quickly, I think, as universities. And so I think that when you have these incredibly kowtowing statements by big tech about diversity and what they're going to do and their grandiose plans, I say to myself, these guys are not going to let it make one bit of difference to the staff that they care about, which is the staff that will keep them at the cutting edge of technology.
All right. Well, let me follow up with that, with the university version of that question. If we're not going to have, I think, by the way, I thought I remembered once, Charles, you saying you thought the SAT had outlived its usefulness. Do I remember that right from 10, 15 years ago?
I have an article, and if you type into your browser, abolish the SAT,
that's
Murray,
right. Yeah.
It'll come up.
Yeah. Okay.
And my point is this, because, and now we're getting to some of the evils of meritocracy. The SAT has taken on a totemistic position in American life, where you have not only kids remember their SAT scores, they see them as a badge of their superiority. And so I said, replace the SAT with achievement tests. Achievement tests in history, and so forth. And you know what the test prep consists of? It consists of learning chemistry. So you wouldn't lose anything, because a wonderful University of California study that came out in the early 2000s, and they had another one more recently, found that you aren't going to hurt the kids who've gone to mediocre high schools by doing that, which surprised me, but I was persuaded by the data. However, Steve Saylor has a set of reforms that I think are even better in terms of how you deal with the SAT.
Well, let's turn to that. Although maybe if you want to, Steve, I mean, do you agree with Charles about the SAT? I always thought it was supposed to be a good predictor of academic success, but I have little expertise in this. So start with that, and then start talking about reforms.
Well,
or alternatives.
You kind of want, you want one big thing, which is, can the kids do the work? And yeah, the best predictor of that tends to be high school GPA, but it takes 3.5 years to get that number. What you also want to be looking out for is, A, we want to be able to treat fairly kids from schools we never heard of, so that, yeah, if the admissions department knows what a 3.7 GPA choate is. They probably don't know what a 3.7 GPA at the Alvin York Agricultural Institute in Tennessee means. So that may bias in favor of, you know, elite schools. But the other thing is, we also want to look out for kids who, for whatever reason, were kind of, you know, can do the work, might do the work in the future, but were sort of alienated from the high school for whatever reason. And there's a lot of reasons when you're a teenager to not get great grades. You know, the richest kid in my high school class got like a 3.1 GPA, but he was always brilliant. You know, he had some issues going on at home and so forth. And then when he got to Berkeley in chemical engineering, he did great. So we're looking out for the diamonds in the rough. The SAT was designed to be kind of a test to find kind of intellectual talent that wasn't showing up in the GPA. And it was pretty useful. But over time, people then say, well, let's, you know, we can study up for this and study more and more and more. And then it doesn't really become that different. It's more of a measure of, you know, are you going to memorize the 2000 vocabulary words and so forth? So this kind of tiger mother era of test prep has left us with the big old-fashioned college admissions tests haven't been really reformed from a perspective of what do we need to do in this new era in the 21st century. Most of the reforms have probably been self-destructive, like getting rid of the analogy questions at the University of California's request about 18 years ago. And they probably made it easier for test prep rather than make it harder. So we need a real study of it. What else do we need? We need to extend the maximum score. Rather than have a written test on paper where people are constantly trying to cheat, we need to have each test be individualized with it on a computer. If you get three questions in a row right, they ask you a harder question. Instead of having 2,000 vocabulary words that some people try to memorize, they should just have 30,000 vocabulary words and they throw them up somewhat at random. They should probably raise the top score from 800 to 900 so that you can find, you know, the real diamonds in the rough. There's a variety of things our society could do if it was a serious culture anymore, but, you know, everything is marketing and political correctness now. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, one difficulty that I like all those ideas. One difficulty that occurs to me is simply the history of how a reasonable idea went off the rails because of ideology. So in admissions, you probably know this, the original idea of affirmative action in the 60s and 70s was, let's go out and find those kids who have ability but don't know it. You know, they're in bad schools or bad neighborhoods or their parents didn't go to college, and encourage these people to apply because they'll succeed. Perfectly fine idea. And then, of course, it devolved into quotas and then the Bakke case. Diversity, equity, and inclusion, I have learned, began originally as a retention program. In other words, you do get students who are first generation in their family to go to college. And they typically, especially if they're minorities, have high dropout rates. And you would like to get them to succeed and stay if you can, if they have the ability. And, you know, at Berkeley, I encounter a lot of Hispanic kids. And by the way, a lot of them come to talk to me for office hours, and especially when they learn I'm a conservative and like to talk to them, they start opening up about things. And, well, this gets off our main subject. They often say, I'm a liberal, but I really don't like the conformity of the campus on all these things. But I've had a couple who've been very interesting saying, I didn't even know what a university was in high school. And I wasn't sure what to do. You know, somebody said, take a test. And I went to community college first, and now I transferred here. And kids are doing great. They're great students. They're curious. They're serious. But meanwhile, the whole diversity thing has become a McCarthyite, Maoist confessional racket, right? It's now ideology and not about student retention anymore. And so this is the, you know, the problem is that every good idea gets corrupted by the left. That was a rant, not a question. I'm sorry, but I couldn't help it.
But that gives me a chance to say that it's not very often that you can point to a single thing, single policy, and say, this is the culprit. And I will argue that you look at aggressive affirmative action, and this is the culprit. That if it weren't for aggressive affirmative action, a whole bunch of problems that now exist, racial problems and the rest of it, would disappear. And that in this regard, I think the brilliant book of the last decade is Christopher Caldwell's The Age of Entitlement, which came out a year or so ago, to maybe 2 years now, which basically goes back to the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Look what happened, which wasn't intended, with the huge edifice of law, the huge administrative edifice that has all been created to enforce, in effect, affirmative action. And he points out all the ways in which this is a pervasive disaster for the country in all sorts of dimensions.
Yeah, you know, I'm a little cross with Chris because I think he was way too cranky and incorrect about Reagan. But other than that, his central thesis is correct. It's the little law that ate the Constitution. But there's a great example and why I worry about even what I think would be the correct ruling from the Supreme Court on the Harvard case that I think you're going to take up. Is one reason we got the whole diversity racket is because the Bakke case said, no, you can't have actual fixed quotas, but you can have diversity. And that was only one justice, right? And you know, there you go. Even when we win, we lose. It's very discouraging.
Yeah, probably a fixed quota where it's like, okay, rank everybody from top to bottom. Yeah, we'll go further down among Blacks and Hispanics and among whites and Asians, but we'll do it. But the administrative burden of enforcing a simple quota is pretty small when the Supreme Court tells you you have to do it holistically and in a very vague sense. Yeah, it leads to hiring a whole bunch of people whose jobs are to kind of obfuscate reality and agitate to get more people like themselves hired to be their underlings.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, now, Steve, you have made a suggestion that I think I've made the same one a few times. I add one part to it. You know, the Ivy League universities sitting on these enormous endowments have not expanded their student bodies very much, even as the population has grown, even as the pool of students with the top test scores and grades has grown. And you sort of wonder why they haven't. I think they want to make it more and more exclusive and so forth. But I've said, I think you've said, why don't we say, you know, here's the threshold for qualifying to get into Harvard, whatever scheme you want to use, test grades, other holistic things if you want, and then admit by lottery rather than picking and choosing. I have run this by some Harvard and Yale grads I know in Princeton. Some conservatives were very critical of the way all this works, and they're horrified at the idea. They tell me that's the worst thing I've ever heard. Yeah, but say a little more on that if you want.
Actually, though, here's where Michael Sandel, I think, makes a really good point in his book, The Tyranny of Merit. And it goes to the real problems with meritocracy are not that able people get ahead in life. That's not the problem. One of the main problems is that the people who get ahead in life increasingly, because of their confidence that they are superior people for having achieved their success in life, are divorcing themselves from the rest of the population, in contempt of the rest of the population. And a contributor to that is the fact that if you get into Harvard, Princeton, Yale, you think, oh, I am the best of the best. I've been winnowed to the top 1,200 out of 40,000 applicants. And what Sandel says is more sophisticated than a lottery. I mean, a simple lottery. He says, look, you got 40,000 applicants. By the time you have the first couple of cuts, you are no longer selecting the best of the best. Because at that point, if we'll leave aside the legacies, we'll leave aside the affirmative action thing, and we're now talking about really capable kids, and you don't know that kid A, who's a valedictorian with 800 SATs, is any better than another kid with 800 and valedictorian. You are making these judgments now, but you aren't really getting a bunch of kids who are better, and you're probably passing over a bunch of kids who would actually be better. All of this, by the way, is supported by the quantitative research, which has shown that people who are put on the waiting list at Harvard and then don't get in versus those who are on the waiting list and do get in, the ones who go to other schools do just as well in later life. Okay, so Sandel says, you get rid of the first 30,000 or you're down to 8,000 or 6,000 for your 1,200 applicants, then you do a lottery. He says you aren't harming the quality of the student body at all, because by that time you're already with an incredibly talented bunch of kids. And the really wonderful thing is that every kid who gets rejected at that point, who is in the final lottery, can say, I got unlucky. They don't have to feel crushed or rejected. They just got unlucky. And even more important, the kids who do get in are forced to admit, I got lucky.
Yes.
And I think that would be such a good thing for every student who is admitted to Harvard and gets to that campus, to have to say to themselves, I'm not actually one in a billion. I got lucky.
And that's probably exactly why it won't happen.
Yeah.
Yes, well said.
All right. Well, I've got a couple more questions of a somewhat more general nature. Several people on Twitter wanted to know if there's any particular disagreements you two have. I don't, you know, whether either broad or some narrow point. I don't know if either one of you thought about it that specifically or not, but I thought I'd raise that question. Now, Steve, I know, really, you know, you're...
I try not to have disagreements with a great empirical researcher like Charles. You know, it's kind of like, oh, Charles has discovered this. Well, I better incorporate that into my worldview. So,
yeah.
I know of no empirical statement Steve has ever made that I've sort of raised my eyebrows and said, is he sure about that? I'm sure there's
some, but I do try to be careful.
I
link to everything.
I'm not aware of any distance between us on any empirical issues. And I'm not sure ideologically we have blessedly not named him who shall not be named.
The Murray household, right.
Who has been president of the United States. We've stayed away from that, and I just seem to continue to. It's possible that Steve and I have somewhat different perspectives on him. But I'm not even sure ideologically if there's... See, I've shifted my position on immigration. Mm-hmm. I've always been in favor of enforcing borders. I'm now much readier to accept severe limits on low-skilled immigration. So mm-hmm. I think I'm probably closer to Steve on immigration than I used to be.
Yeah.
I don't really know.
So it's not making for a great mono-a-mono debate.
Well, it didn't do a little that way. I mean, again, like I was saying earlier, it's similar minds are often more interesting to dive into things than people who violently disagree. I do want to ask you this in particular, Steve. I mean, Charles I've known for a long time, and, you know, he lets the attacks roll off him like water off a duck's back, in part because he says he's old now and they can't, what can they do to him, right, Charles? But good grief, Steve, you're utterly fearless. I mean, no matter what the subject is, I always know I can count on you to go there, as the saying goes. And, you know, both of you have to put up the slanders from the SPLC and, you know, all the other sort of stuff. How do you deal with it? How do you put up with it? Or do you just ignore it?
Well, I'm a lot more obscure than Charles, so I haven't been assaulted by Antifa ski bums at Middlebury. So there's a lot to be said for obscurity. The SPLC thing is pretty hilarious because let me talk about my old nemesis, Morris Dees. Now, you know, Morris, last I heard, was on his sixth wife. Morris basically has the skill set of a televangelist, but he just figured out a long time ago that poor Southern conservatives have less money to give to him than rich liberal Northerners. And so he came up with a great money-making machine, and he loved to raise money. And eventually, you know, he's just tremendously good at it. Eventually, he wasn't spending all the money he was raising, so it was just kind of piling up. So he got Me Too'd and kind of canceled a couple of years ago in an obscure scandal, and the SPLC announced they were hiring Tina Chen, Michelle Obama's chief of staff, to write a big report on why they'd fired their legendary founder. But then she got in all sorts of trouble over about three other scandals she was involved in, like Jussie Smollett and all sorts of stuff. And so there's never been a report, but yeah. Nobody cares. The SPLC is a brand name. And so, and they're considered to be good, even if, you know, Morris was a great American rogue in his time. And I kind of admire him more than the little people who have taken over his pile of money since then.
Well, you know, I don't follow them closely. Who would, who has any sense? But I do think that it's paradoxically their star might have fallen a little bit in the last couple of years, precisely because BLM and other, you know, radical enthusiasms have ascended so quickly. Wouldn't that be a sort of rough justice in an odd way?
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, Morris got fired by the SPLC. You know, there's a lot of money there, and people want to spend that money.
Right. All right. I think that, last question, although depending on what you guys say, we might go further into overtime. You know, a lot of people think that wokeness, the fever of wokeness, is breaking, that it's going to start to recede, that there's reasons to think that it's playing itself out. I'm not so sure about that, but my question for both of you guys is, can things get worse, do you think?
Yeah, sure.
Well, I sometimes joke that things
admit, okay, is the general establishment going to go, Charles Murray was right about all this stuff all along, and we were wrong, and actually Charles is a better person than I am, and I'm going to apologize. That's asking a lot of human beings.
I think, along with Herbert Stein, an economist who was at AEI for so many years, his saying was, if something can't go on forever, it won't. And in the case of the progressive left now, and the systemic racism and the wokeness and all the rest of that, it is floating free of reality. And that cannot persist forever. Now, you don't have the same kind of built-in dynamic that you have in the hard sciences. In the hard sciences, you have tremendous resistance to paradigm-breaking discoveries. But the fact is, it wasn't that long after Galileo was dropping things off the tower that there were no longer any Aristotelian physicists. Didn't take that long. Didn't take that long after Copernicus was published for there no longer to be any Ptolemaic astronomers. And in a sociological sense, we have a similar situation here. America is actually not a systemically racist country. Certainly against blacks, that if you were an observer from Mars who looks at the American labor market and the American educational system, you would say that America is systemically racist in favor of blacks and, to a lesser extent, Latinos, and is systemically racist against Asians. Well, if that is the reality, you can't forever after get away with trying to say to people that the emperor has clothes on. Sooner or later, they say, no, he actually doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, what we've seen is as the decades go by, and we're now in the second half century post all the civil rights acts, that discourse has become ever more antiquarian. And, you know, I get some laughs, but it's serious. But basically, Emmett Till from 1955 is in the headlines constantly in 2022. FDR's redlining is repeatedly referred to as this crucial impact on the way we live today. So we've seen our culture just engage in an act of amnesia about basically life in America since 1964 and obsess ever more about pre-1964. Now, is that ridiculous? Yeah. Is it unsustainable? I don't know. I mean, power finds ways of sustaining itself.
Well, and here's the dynamic that's not going to go away. And here is where I think we not only will not see the fever break, we are in for rough waters. And that's the imponderable as to what's going on in white America at this point. Not among racists, but among the people in the heartland, the working class whites, the middle class whites, virtually everybody except the white elites, who are sick and tired of being told they're evil and oppressive by these same elites. And the fact that the white elites are joining in this mea culpa, just makes it more irritating. And so you have a whole lot of whites sitting watching the TV now and watching the news and hearing the allegations that are being made. And they're saying something in the order of, well, give me a break, you know, and the extent to which this is resulting in antagonism, I don't think specifically so much racist antagonism, but anti-elite antagonism, is going to have effects. They may work themselves out with the electoral process. It may be you're going to have a massive shift in Washington with this election, but more likely it will be less decisive than that. And here is where I think the polarization is going to get worse rather than better. I think it's very hard to overestimate the anger at non-elite white America against the elites. That anger is deep, it is strong, and it is, I think, producing a separatist kind of attitude, which I'm not saying will result in civil war, but I do think is going to prevent any reconciliation in the foreseeable future and probably an intensification of the antagonism.
Well, this does prompt one more big question. So for overtime here that a few people on Twitter brought up, and that is, the Civil War thing is a bit fanciful, but what about some kind of national divorce? What about the country actually splitting up? I mean, the problem, Charles, with Herbert Stein's old comment, which I've always loved too, is something that can't go on forever won't. Maybe the thing that can't go on forever is the United States.
Yeah. But would that fix much? I don't know. I mean, but partly there's no real way to divide the U.S. up into red and blue. You know, it's a practical
problem. It's hard.
The world's most complicated map. It's, you know, you can't put a national border 27 miles out from downtown of 20 cities. Another is Americans, especially since the rise of social media, really get on each other's nerves. are we going to like stop and only talk to people in our part of the country? And I think we'll just go stay right at it. Another aspect is I think I think basically, if you start talking about national divorce, it sort of ends up with the military basically having the final say. And I think the military says, no, we like being the biggest, strongest country and military in the world. And no, we're not going to stand for this. You know, we're not going to split up our aircraft carriers into two different countries. We're going to stay together and be the world's most kick-ass military.
I don't think that there's a national divorce is feasible for the reasons that Steve just gave, plus some others. I do think that an end to American democracy the chances of American democracy as we know it disintegrating are non-trivially greater than zero. Now, whether that means 2% or 5% or 10%, I don't know. But with all of the rhetoric about the guardrails held during the Trump years, well, they sort of held, but they are still under assault during the last year, in some ways even more strongly than they were before. And what we are seeing is a general erosion, which sooner or later will get rid of the filibuster by one party or the other. And once that goes, and then you can think of a variety of other things that go, then you lose legitimacy even more in institutions whose legitimacy is already in deep doubt. You add into that the emergence of a charismatic leader who is simply much more adept in the use of power than Donald Trump. You know, it's when I say non-trivially greater than zero, it's worth taking seriously. I think the erosion is deep. The rot is deep. And I don't see how we come back.
Yeah. I mean, my view is a huge problem is the Democrats have settled upon a grand strategy of using diversity to win. And that's inevitably divisive. And it causes all sorts of troubles. Now, what are my solutions? Well, part of my solution is just, let's just point out what the Democrats have done and that it's diversity that's the cause of divisiveness. And they should be ashamed of exploiting racial difference, divisiveness, gender divisiveness between men and women. That's really lowering the level of happiness in the United States when you put men and women at each other's throats. And they should be ashamed of it, and they should stop doing it, or they should lose the elections. But even just pointing out the basics that, yeah, diversity is divisive and that's inevitable. So you gotta be cautious and prudent and not so opportunistic about it. And you should be ashamed of some of the things you've done. You know, that's considered unsayable. And if it's unsayable, it's unthinkable. So nobody thinks about it.
Well,
you know what the best optimistic thing I can think of is? For the future, the popularity of Ted Lasso.
Okay.
And the reason I say that is people, everybody I know just about who's seen, they love the show. And they love the show because it's about a bunch of people that they like who are trying to do the right thing. And I think there is a yearning out there, a yearning for a much more traditional kind of discourse than we've had. And maybe there is a potential there for somebody saying something as revolutionary as, why don't we treat everybody as other Americans, as individuals, and we're going to like some of them, we're going to dislike others of them, but I'm saying essentially the same thing Steve was. Let's not spend so much time talking about race. let's not spend so much time talking about these groups. Let's talk about our fellow Americans. And I will make one more statement of optimism. And I hope it's true of you as it is of me. I listen to all this rhetoric, this very divisive racial rhetoric at the national level. And then I think in terms of my own personal relationships, my own encounters with Blacks or Latinos or Asians or anybody. And I say, have they deteriorated? And no, they haven't. At a micro level, and I live in a county that has substantial minority populations, at a micro level, I don't see anything except the kind of potential for getting along that Americans have always had.
Yeah.
That pretty much exhausts my reservoir of optimism. It's not my strong point, you know?
It's basically opportunistic activists who see how the rhetoric, the logic of the conventional wisdom could make them a lot of money. And let's just point that out.
Yeah, our elites are pretty rotten. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I say that is as good as most optimistic as we can possibly hope for as a place to end, I think.
All right.
Thank you, Charles. Thank you, Steve. This has been fabulous.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, quite obviously, we could have gone on forever. And there were a lot of related subjects I wanted to take up, such as, for example, the mismatch hypothesis that Rick Sanders and Stuart Taylor worked out so well in their fine book that mostly summarizes the extensive academic literature about the harm caused to minorities by affirmative action admissions policies, findings that the media and college admissions departments resolutely ignore. Now, if the Supreme Court strikes down or greatly curtails affirmative action college admissions next year, and remember, the case won't be argued until this fall and likely not decided until June of 2023, there's going to be a great crisis in the civil rights industry. And I think we'll want to have Charles and Steve back to survey the scene and anticipate how colleges and the rest of the world is going to adapt. Before going, though, I do want to make a brief commercial announcement. For listeners of our companion podcast, The Three Whiskey Happy Hour, tomorrow, Lucretia and I will be welcoming Conrad Black to the bar as we have a spirited discussion about what we call the FDR question. Now, Conrad is a conservative outlier in admiring Franklin Roosevelt and thinking more conservatives should too. You're not going to want to miss this one, though I don't think I'll be giving anything away if I say that Lucretia is largely unpersuaded. So bye-bye, everybody. Hope to see you again soon.
Life's about and grow up just like that. Ricochet. Join the conversation.